Ready to go?
Okay. What's up? This is Movies on Up. No leader can survive becoming a legend. The man seated across from me is
legend.
The man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Dave Pacella. That's Mr. Dave. I am Ryan. We are Movies on Up. Our tagline for this week is No leader can survive becoming a legend. If you think you know what movie that is from, you can send your guest to us in one of the following ways. You can email us, moviesonup@gmail.com. You can leave it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/moviesonup, or you can tweet your guest to us at moviesonup on the Twitter if you are correct. And if we choose you, you will win yourself a legendary Movies on Up prize package that will be delivered straight to your door. Straight to the theaters this week is Tim Burton's live-action adaptation of Dumbo. It becomes the latest of the Disney movies. Not the first and certainly not the last.
What, four of them this year, I think?
There's quite a few because we still got Aladdin coming
down. There's
Dumbo,
Aladdin, Lion King, maybe another one.
Yeah, maybe it feels like because there's three in such short succession, it makes you think that Beauty and the Beast didn't happen that long ago, but I want to think that was 2017.
Yeah,
maybe?
That was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but certainly not waiting more than but about a couple months now to get these live action things. And we were grasping for some ideas on what we could do for that. Do we want to do our favorite movies with elephants? That might be. It'd just be Ong Bak 1 through 3, Water for Elephants, and
Operation
Dumbo
Drop.
Exactly. There you go. And then we thought about Tim Burton, and we thought, could we do our five favorite Tim Burton movies? Absolutely, we could. They'd be the same movies, probably in a pretty similar order. So Dave had the suggestion of just focusing on one movie that would absolutely be in both of our top fives, and that is 2004's Big Fish. I like that movie a lot, and we don't really talk about it a lot on the show.
No, and it's one of those that I try to bring up when I can, but it's not one that I get to bring up a bunch. I do say that there are certain, like, he is one of them. I do throw Perfect Movie on some stuff. This is one of them that's pretty damn close. I think this movie is, I'm a big fan of this movie. That'll come out as it goes, but spoiler alert, I absolutely adore this movie.
And I think there's some movies that we talk a lot about because they very clearly fit into a genre, or even into multiple genres. So when we do our stupid female-led action heroes list, okay, this isn't that.
3.0.
Exactly. This one's tough to put into a genre. We haven't done our favorite Albert Finney or Billy Crudup movies. I feel like Ewan's probably got a list episode gesticulating.
And you know what? I was so excited to do the Jude Law episode a few weeks ago.
Right.
Until I realized, like, oh, he's different. It's not Ewan McGregor. So... So, like, I was excited because I'm automatically thinking, like, oh, Big Fish. And I'm just thinking all these Ewan movies. And it's like,
Attack of the Clones.
No, that's not it. So, yeah, I'm going to squeeze a Ewan McGregor list in there somewhere. We have to.
Yeah.
And this will be number one.
Right. We'll get the opportunity to do that. So I think this is why the movie doesn't come up an awful lot. If we're not maybe specifically discussing Tim Burton, it's not going to, which is, on the one hand, unfair to Big Fish, but on the other hand, it's the reason that it's getting its own episode. That will be this week. Tim Burton's Big Fish, starring the aforementioned Ewan McGregor, Albert Finney, and Billy Crudup. It opened in wide release on January 9th, 2004, to $13.8 million, which was good for second place. I want to say just about $400,000 behind Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. Cheaper by the Dozen, Cold Mountain, and Something's Got to Give. Round out your top five for that week. Big Fish went on to gross $66.8 million domestically, I believe, on about a $75 million budget, which put it at number 1,207 on the all-time domestic list, one spot below this 2002 movie featuring a Jedi Master and Daredevil.
I don't know that one.
It's Changing Lanes, Samuel L. Jackson and Ben Affleck. And this was one spot above 1989's John Candy Macaulay Culkin comedy,
Uncle Buck.
Uncle Buck, absolutely. For a little context, a man who's no stranger to Star Wars, although some wish perhaps maybe he were, Rian Johnson's Looper is a bit down further on the list in 1,213th place, and A Medea Family Funeral is in 1,229th, which I think is why we were thinking about doing The Death at a Funeral, because
that was a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Funeral comedies, and that's kind of what this was. That answered that question that no one was still considering except me and Dave. And Madea is actually one spot below 1995's Bad Boys. So
I like Bad Boys.
I do too. Speaking of, we're getting the Bad Boys sequel that we so desperately. Is that this year?
I don't know. It's been so off and on forever.
But it is on.
Yeah.
It's happening. Bad Boys, Bill and Ted, like it's all coming home to roost, thankfully. Big Fish is a really fascinating movie for Tim Burton to make, especially given when it came out in 2004. From a career standpoint, it becomes right in the middle of this Planet of the Apes and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory time, where I feel like those movies didn't necessarily scream. I mean, Charlie more so because it had Johnny Depp, but they didn't have the same color palette. It still had a Tim Burton flair to it, but it wasn't what you would characterize the early and the later parts of his career. Those, when you think of Tim Burton movies, whether it's Frankenweenie or Dark Shadows, that's very much in the oeuvre.
Alice in Wonderland.
Right. Of Alice or Edward Scissorhands, Beetlejuice. This movie was just kind of like right in the middle of everything, but completely different from everything.
Yeah. If you look, you had the, you know, Batman was kind of just his, you know, Batman and Batman Returns, but then you had Beetlejuice, Ed Wood, Mars Attacks, Sleepy Hollow. These are all his like quirky, kind of darker movies. And then Planet of the Apes was like, oh, here he's a big-time blockbuster studio director. But maybe that wasn't the right fit. And then you have Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which from there is when your colors come. And Alice in Wonderland, Dark Shadows, Frankenweenie, Corpse Bride. So it's like, it is two sections of his career, and this is right in the middle of them.
It's strange. I think he's most commonly known for, like, Batman and Edward Scissorhands, Beetlejuice. Those all work with a lot of blacks and whites. But even something like Mars Attacks had a lot of color to it, like Charlie did. He's either going to go black and white, or he's going to do a lot of colors. And certainly, I think Big Fish falls into the more colors, but it's not even like he started with monochrome and went to color. Because he still has monochrome in the later part of his career.
It's a bright, bright movie. I love the color in Big Fish.
Yeah, it's weird to have a director. I want to say this is like a midlife crisis for Tim Burton, but that's usually a negative connotation. Like, you go do something so far out of character that's bad and harmful. This, I do believe, was out of character for him, but in a great
way.
It's
filled with hope, I guess, like, compared to the rest of his filmography. Like, there are colors in other movies, but there's always that overwhelming sense of dread in his movies. Like, yeah. Charlie, it's essentially a horror movie,
right.
You know. Mars Attacks is an alien invasion movie. So even when he is playing with colors, there's this dread to it. And in all his movies, really, there's this dread. There's just something not right. Big Fish, I think, does away with that. It's the bright color. It's this hopeful world. It's the only Tim Burton world where he's great at building worlds. It's the only world where it's not like, oh, this is all going to go to shit. You don't get that sense of this is all going to come crashing down and this is going to leave me in a bad mood.
I think that's part of the style, certainly with Burton. And I think it's something that he's aware of. The criticism of him as a director is style over substance, or not even over, but style as a replacement for substance. But I don't think that was the case here. Go back to Pee-wee, and then shortly after Pee-wee, when he was doing Beetlejuice and Batman, it was really fresh. And can I blame Tim Burton for people copying his style and every movie's Halloween Town now and this Hot Topic style has morphed into other directors too, so it seems like Burton stuff is played out when it's really not. People are just kind of copying him. But when his stuff is good, Edward Scissorhands, or hell, even Ed Wood, there's heart to it. And I think there's a heart to Big Fish that comes through in this movie.
I think more than anything else he's done. The heart is kind of a side dish on all the rest of his movies that do have just a nut. Like, Eddie Scissorhands has enough heart to get it there. You know,
right.
It's not, it's more quirky, it's more weird, but it's got enough heart. This movie is just all heart, and the quirky and weird is the side dish.
It's almost like to have a relationship with someone. Like, when you're younger, you're a bit awkward, you don't really know how to articulate that relationship. And I kind of feel like, you know, that's Beetlejuice. That's a little Ed Wood. That's certainly Edward Scissorhands, but this is like fully formed adult knowing how to articulate your feelings for someone. And in this case, it happened to be a father and a son. But that relationship, while strained, it never seemed awkward. It seemed like an adult relationship.
And Billy Crudup's narration at the beginning, where it's like, yeah, we didn't talk for 3 years after that. It didn't feel like this estrangement. He wasn't shut off. He still talked to his mom. But when he was talking to his mom, the dad was either, you know, he ran outside or he was out taking the trash out. So it's not like he still knew, you know, he wasn't completely estranged from him. They just didn't talk, which is something adults do. Like, I have friends that I don't talk to for a year or two at a time, and then I run into them and it's like, oh, it's like we never left. So it's very adult. And I like that it was like, yes, this son and father weren't talking, but at no point were they estranged. At no point was it a tragedy. It wasn't this tragic relationship.
And that's really at the center of the movie is the father-son relationship, which Burton's always been a guy that's done well with adapting literature, whether it's Alice in Wonderland or, you know, Batman. So I got to thinking, like, what was it about Big Fish? Because it does seem so different than the types of movies he usually makes. What was it about this book, this story, that he thought, I've got to be the one that makes it? And I had read an interview he gave to The Morning Call, like just before the movie came out. And he said that he had read the book right about the time that his father had died. And he was not terribly close with his father, much like Crudup was in this movie. And actually, by the time they were done filming this, he had his first kid with Helena Bonham Carter, so he became a father during all this. And I think that was maybe the impetus behind having some feeling behind the eyeliner. You see directors kind of change their styles here and there, and it seems weird. Kevin Smith is always one that he made Jersey Girl. He made it for his daughter, and it was about being a father. I like Jersey Girl a lot. It's much different than the rest of his stuff, but I kind of look at Big Fish in a similar way.
There are some movies that feel like love letters. Jersey Girl is one of those, but there are directors who, they make a certain movie that maybe feels out of place. It feels like a love letter. It just feels like them dedicating it to somebody else, and that's what this is. It's a love letter to his color palette. It's a love letter to his filmmaking. It's a love letter to quirky actors doing their thing, and it's, at its heart, it's for adapting a book, kind of autobiographical. Like, you have the guy whose father is passing away, who's about to have a son. So, you know, he didn't write the book, but he saw a lot of himself in his situation in that book, and it shows.
Yeah, I don't mean to say that Burton's an odd director to direct this story, because when you think about it, I think his...
Very much a Burton story.
Yes, yeah. Like this whimsical storytelling... That's Tim Burton. So, like, this in theory would be in his wheelhouse. Now, admittedly, it's a more optimistic whimsy than we usually see, but not necessarily something that I wouldn't imagine he'd be capable of. But we talk a lot about directors getting in their own way. And I think what I mean when I say that is that a director is sort of overly reliant on their own style. Big Fish represents one of the very few times in his career, and in my opinion, the last time that Burton was able to resist that temptation of leaning on his quote-unquote style so much, letting his actors act and tell the story. His visuals, I think, added to the movie and brought life to the stories that Ewan and company kind of smile their way through.
And that's the thing, because I think the closest thing to maybe what this movie was in his filmography is maybe Big Eyes from 2014, because that... He let the actors tell the story, but it lacked that Tim Burton charm. It just fell flat.
It was like a painting.
Yeah, the story wasn't as whimsical, and it had that sense of dread. Whereas he easily could have played up the strained relationship, played up the impending death that was coming up. Like, all this stuff could have brought the story down and added that dread. He didn't. He avoided it. And he made this really optimistic story about, here's your dad that you haven't seen in 3 years. He's getting ready to die. It's not a sad thing. Billy Crudup goes right up there with the can of Ovaltine. Drink half of it. I'll tell mom you drank the whole thing. Like, after not talking for 3 years, that's it. That's just, drink half this can. I'll tell mom you drank the whole thing. Then everybody went. There was no awkwardness of not talking for 3 years. It was just, That's his dad. He knew deep, like he knew that was his dad. He accepted that's his dad. And it just, it worked. The conversations they had could have gotten a lot darker, and they didn't. He just kept this optimism throughout the entire thing, which for this story, it's very hard to remain as optimistic and bright, but he pulled it off.
And we're certainly going to come back to the optimism, but all the characters in this movie, with very few exceptions, they're all likable. There's no monster or bad character. It's kind of like a celebration. And even though I think Ewan's accent was a little bit rough, I loved the relationship between Ewan and then, you know, Finney and Billy Crudup specifically, and Jessica Lange in there as well. You could understand the dynamics of the family. And when Jenny later in the movie says to Will that there's only two women in the world, your mom and everyone else, he did a wonderful job of showing you that relationship. And that was what was driving the story, not some weird... And he had a chance with the giant. He could have made that a weird creature.
Yeah,
he was didn't
do it. Really likable guy. And like, and Alison Lohman, very understated and underused in this movie. Her job was to go out there and be perfect. Be the world. Be somebody who, upon seeing you, you are the entire world. And she did that. And where I give him credit is she wasn't this object that, like, I have to have. It was just, that's who I'm going to marry. This is my world. She was never an object that he had to win. She was this future that he wanted. And she was never objectified, but she was perfect. And then even as Jessica Lange, you are somebody's world. And they both pulled it off. That casting between them, age-wise, because Jessica Lange is beautiful in this movie. Like, her at the end, like in the river, she's gorgeous in this movie. She looks like a grown-up Alison Lohman. Alison Lohman looks like a young Jessica Lange. Like, and their whole job in this movie is be perfect. Be worth going through everything he says
getting
he's
shot
gone
out of a
through.
Cannon.
Yes. Like,
put your head in the lion's mouth.
Be the world that somebody has to fight to keep. And that is it. It's you and everybody else. I thought they pulled it off really, really well. And I thought he did really good job of doing that without being gross.
Yeah, and just letting the characters tell the story, which in a movie where your main character, it's what he is. He's a storyteller. The stories, I think, were able to become the stars. You know, whether it was the story of how Ed and Sandra meet, time stops, or Ed's adventures in Korea, Burton really paced the hell out of this movie. None of the stories seemed like they were way too long. None of them seemed too short. And even when we go back to the present, it doesn't feel like the movie's just dragging until we get to another story.
And every time leaves you wanting more. Because when you go back to Finney and Crudup, or Crudup and Jessica Lange, it's like, oh, I want to see more of Ewan being Ewan. But then by the time it's time to get back to you, and it's like, oh, I want to hear Albert Finney talk more. Like, I want to hear him with that little drawl. Like, I want to hear him talk more. I want to see more of that. So it's like every time, you know, you're bouncing between timelines, and each time it's like you want more. Like, he doesn't let them drag out. They're succinct. They're perfect. It moves along. It's beautifully paced. It's wonderfully acted. Everybody in this movie is so good. Like, Helena Bonham Carter is in a couple roles, and she's just really good. She's this thing where it's like, you could absolutely have a second life with this woman. A normal guy would.
Yeah.
Not Edward Bloom. Everybody's so good, and he just let them act. The cast was great. You have a really talented cast. It all played to their strengths. You had Crudup was the straight guy. Albert Finney was just this, he's not going to do much, but he's talking, and he can talk. And then you got Ewan, who this is just peak Ewan. Just go out there and be the most charismatic person in the world. And that's what he was. And there are a few actors that I could see pulling this off. He's got this arrogance of he knows he's this big fish in a little pond, but he's got this charm and this charisma.
But
that,
you like him still.
You want him. You want to be in his pond. You want to follow him to whatever pond he is, where a lot of people play that, and they're just arrogant. It is really one of those that, like, this movie is damn near perfect. I try not to say that about that many. I think there's only maybe a handful that I say, but this is, it's a damn near perfect movie with everything about it.
And we've given Tim Burton a lot of credit for, I guess, resisting his baser urge to Tim Burton this movie. And I don't even mean to use that as a negative verb, because when Tim Burton's good, I like Tim Burton, but
he's a co-star here.
Yeah.
And that's where
you're right. It's not Tim Burton's Big Fish.
Exactly. And that's where, like, you know, in some of Wes Anderson's later movies, like, Wes Anderson is the star.
Yes.
And that's what I mean when I say, like, getting in the way is when the director is the star of the movie. That's where I have issues with it. Whereas Big Fish, it's very much a Tim Burton movie. Tim Burton style is very much a character in this movie, but he's a co-star in this great ensemble movie. It came out great. He sat aside. He still brought his A game and delivered, but wasn't front and center. And it was amazing.
Another guy that I think we have to give a certain amount of credit for not over-injecting his style is Danny Elfman. He was nominated for Best Original Score for the movie. And there are certain composers, and it's because they're fantastically successful, you might have an idea of what a Hans Zimmer score sounds like, or a John Williams, or even a Danny Elfman, because the guys are really good at their job. But I do think that Danny Elfman and Zimmer, they both have very distinct styles that can sometimes be oppressive. But guys that are so, they have such a distinct style, Elfman and Burton, and they work together. They work together well, and they work together a lot. But both of them were able to kind of dial it back and be supporting of the story here. And I think that's fantastic for somebody to be able to, that's that talented, to be able to step back and say, all right, maybe I don't need to crank it up to 11 here.
I just watched this today. Like, this is fresh. And it is perfect, because Danny Elfman has some of these scores that are just larger than life, and you know they're there. Not this one. This score is very, very subtle. Edward Blum doesn't have a superhero theme, which this kind of character would be very easy to have a superhero theme. So it's going to be a weird compliment, but nothing of the score sticks out to me, because you absorb the whole thing. So he's not trying to outshine everything else. And him, very much just like Tim Burton, is a co-star. And this was an ensemble movie all across. And it's the score, the direction, the acting. Everybody is at the same level, and nobody's trying to one-up everybody. And it just works.
You mentioned optimism, and even almost unrealistically optimistic. We know that it's a Tim Burton movie, so I think we're kind of expecting that these stories that we hear for, you know, the most of the movie, by the time Albert Finney's character dies, I don't think we're actually expecting them to be real. And now, they weren't all 100% accurate. You know, the giant wasn't so big that he was going to flip a car over. And the twins were too different, right.
Yeah.
There was enough to lend credence to what he said, so that these stories, instead of being maybe 90% bullshit, they were probably 90% true.
They were just embellished.
Yeah, they were embellished a little bit, but that's not necessarily the way at first watch I thought this was going to go, because it's a Tim Burton movie.
I just want to jump in, because it's the same as what we said about Elfman and Danny Burton.
Elfman and Tim Burton.
Yeah, because Albert Finney's death is one of my favorite movie deaths ever. It's one of the most beautiful, most impactful death scenes ever, but it's not over the top at all. That's exactly how it happened, and that's it. It's so beautiful, and this guy is a hero. Like, Edward Blum is a superhero, and he could have had this over-dramatic, drawn-out death. And he didn't get it, but it was perfect.
He got it in the way
that Edward Blum lived life.
A story.
Yes, and it was so good, and it was so perfect. Like,
from his son, who's now picked up
the
importance of perhaps embellishment and telling a good story, knowing that it's really about the heart of the story, the minor details about how tall someone was or whether or not they turned into a fish. Who gives a shit? You're still getting the point across. And
I love that scene so much.
Yeah.
Like that. I watched it. Albert Finney passed away not too long ago, and I immediately went and watched just that scene. I didn't have time to rewatch all of Big Fish at that moment, but just that scene is just so perfect. And Albert Finney's so good in this movie. I miss him so much.
But at least optimism, bright, are not necessarily what we'd use to describe a normal Tim Burton movie. And I was trying to figure out where this movie belongs in relation to Burton. it's basically right in the middle chronologically. It's right in the middle when it comes to box office as well. I mean, you have like Batman and Alice are real high up there, and then you got some movies, you know, Pee-wee and Big Eyes, that are way down there. This one's kind of right in the middle too. In terms of quality of his movies, I think it's way closer to the top than it is the middle. It may not be my favorite. That might be Beetlejuice just for nostalgia, but I think it's by far his best movie.
It's my favorite Tim Burton movie. I've said that before, but it's by far my favorite. And I like Beetlejuice. I like Batman. I like Batman Returns. I like a lot of his movies, mostly his early stuff, but not like this movie. This is probably a top 20 movie for me ever. I love this movie. It's just so good. I love it so much. And it's by far my favorite of his.
It really makes me wish that we're able to see. I'm not trying to say I want Big Fish 2, but the movies I think that Tim Burton's made recently, I think have been very commercial and, you know, for lack of a better word, just style driven. Like, I just need to have a new Tim Burton movie. But after, you know, seeing Big Fish, like, his early stuff was good. It was a really good combination of, you know, like we said, the heart and the substance. Big Fish, I think, is just taking both of those things and maxing them out. So I know he has the ability to do it. I just want to see it more from him. I don't need to see Dark Shadows.
Big Eyes, I respect, like, he tried to go small and do that.
Yeah.
Miss Peregrine's, like, yeah, if you're going to make that book a movie, I can't, even reading it, it felt like a Tim Burton book. So, like, I get that, but it just missed that magic. Maybe because he, I don't know, you could tell he didn't have the personal connection to it that he did with Big Fish or with something he writes. And Dumbo, I don't know. The cast is great.
I mean, I'm watching the circus scene in Big Fish, and I'm thinking, oh, it's pretty much just Danny DeVito, yep, like 20 years later.
Yep, Danny DeVito in a top hat.
Yeah.
Like in Batman Returns and in Big Fish.
Yeah, I have no doubt that at least that part of Dumbo is going to be awesome. I mean, that's Tim Burton can make a circus. That's going to be fine. And maybe that's going to have more of the heart to it. Maybe Dumbo is the movie that I've been wanting Tim Burton to make for the last 15 years. I hope so, because I know he's got it in him to do it. And it's not necessarily like Shyamalan, where you just want him to come back because you know it's in him. But I know what Burton can do. And I don't want this to be the one outlier in his career that happens to just be the best thing he's ever done. Do something else.
Who starred in Operation Dumbo Drop? See, in my head, Operation Dumbo Drop is the elephant movie. It's the Bill Murray elephant movie.
No, that's Danny Glover and Ray Liotta.
Yes, Bill Murray is larger than life. Another elephant movie from 1996.
And Dennis Leary.
Yeah.
And Dougie Doug.
When you mentioned Operation Dumbo Drop earlier, I'm like, wasn't there another elephant movie around the same time? For some reason, I always think Operation Dumbo Drop is Bill Murray. But no, Bill Murray is larger than life.
It's like the, was it Dante's Peak?
And Volcano.
Yeah.
Deep Impact and Armageddon.
Right.
White House Down and Olympus, or
Olympus Has Fallen.
Yeah.
I don't think any of those had Dougie Fresh.
So. I wish. I like Dougie Fresh.
So we go from a quirky movie from a quirky director this week to a quirky actor, quirky character actor, in John Lithgow next week. He is in the new adaptation of Pet Sematary.
Sometimes dead is better.
He plays the Herman Munster role. So we're going to do our favorite John Lithgow movies, which was enlightening. That was a guy that I like John Lithgow. I know I like John Lithgow, the TV guy. It was interesting to see what John Lithgow movies I liked. I'm not going to say it was a ridiculous challenge, but I've got a list. I like my list. But this was very informative for how I think about John Lithgow, the movie star.
I think we're going to feel different.
We might.
Yeah. I could have named my one and two the second that we did it.
Yeah, I wasn't worried about that.
They were very formative of my childhood.
Yes. To find out what those movies are, come back next week. But until then,
keep it up.